Hello and welcome to Series 2, Episode 12 of Out with Susie Ruffle. How are you? I hope you're having a good day. Oh, guys, I feel a lot brighter waking up this morning and watching Joe Biden's acceptance speech to become the next president of the United States. I mean, I appreciate I'm British, but it really feels like a shift towards hope in the world, and it's really given me a spring in my step. A special hello to all of you that live or are American. I know that we've got a lot of American listeners. I assume that you're feeling very happy if you're listening to this podcast, I assume. What a great day for hope, in my opinion. It's a very hopeful day. Thank you for listening. Thank you to all of you that got in touch after last week's episode with Rita. I love her. I think she's brilliant. And it seems that lots of you do too. Thank you to everyone that's left iTunes reviews or shared it on Spotify or tweeted or emailed, Instagrammed or any of the other ways that you can share it. Or if you're not sharing it and you're just listening to it by yourself and no one knows that you listen to it, thank you as well for being here and for being part of this podcast community. I've got a great episode this week. Amber Arcadi, I loved chatting to them. I think you're going to really enjoy it too. But before, as always, we have our listener emails. And I'm going to start right here. Hi, Susie. I know you must be bombarded with emails, but I had to get in touch. I'm constantly listening to a range of different podcasts, but none have affected me anywhere near as much as yours has. I find your podcast to be incredibly powerful, and the messages of hope that it has bestowed upon its listeners are truly inspiring. I grew up as an only child with wonderful parents who were and still are unbelievably supportive in many areas of my life. Despite this, though, they are sadly extremely homophobic. I don't harbour any ill feeling about this because they grew up in a vastly different world to the one we're in today, and without interaction with people from differing backgrounds, it can be difficult to change deeply embedded perceptions. Nevertheless, this has had a profound effect on how I dealt with the realisation age 14 that I was gay. Due to the messaging I had received from them, I concluded that living a homosexual life was simply not an option, so I suppressed not only my sexuality, but a large part of who I was. I spent 7 years in a state of paralysis, feeling confused, alone, and clueless as to what to do next. When I went off to university, a wave of shame and unhappiness regarding my sexuality washed over me. Hiding my true self had negatively impacted me in more ways than I could ever have possibly imagined. It was at that point that I realised I could not live any longer like this and began the process of properly accepting my sexuality. Even with the passing of this important stage, I had no role models in my own life to turn to. And a lot of the media portrayals of gay people who were ultra flamboyant was something I simply couldn't relate to. My initial feelings of relief had quickly turned to dust. I felt so alone. When I stumbled upon your podcast, though, I once again began to feel hope for the future. Listening to the show has shown me the LGBTQIA+ community really does encompass all manner of people. There is no right way to be gay, and it's given me the confidence to finally come out to my parents. Words cannot describe how unbelievably grateful I am to you and your guests. Thank you for all your podcast has done for me, and I hope that it'll be around for a long time to come. Oh, I think you could hear that. That got me right in the feels. Thank you for sending in that email. JP is what you call yourself in it, so that's what I'll call you. I'm really chuffed that the podcast has done that for you, and that's exactly what I was hoping to do when I created this podcast, is show that all kinds of people are part of this community, and everyone's valid, and everyone's important, and everyone belongs here. And that goes for our straight allies as well. You're totally welcome to come to the party as well. Thank you for emailing in. I'm so pleased that the podcast has shown you that you can be gay however you want to be. Yeah, I hope that your relationship with your parents is okay. And may I suggest listening to, I don't know if you've listened to it, but if you haven't, Dustin Black's episode, which was the first one of the first series, there's a lot of conversation in that about allowing people to have time to change their minds about how they feel about stuff. And lots of people have got in touch to say that message really helped them. And so maybe it will help you too. Maybe you've already listened to it. I don't know. If you're a fan of the podcast, you might have, but maybe there's some bits in that one that might be helpful to you right now. But thank you for emailing in. It really meant a lot to me. Okay, on to another email from an ally. Thank you for your wonderful, enlightening podcast. Not only do I find your voice incredibly soothing, sorry if that sounds creepy, it doesn't, I'm delighted, but the stories you bring to light and your interview style is just fantastic. I'm a 34-year-old woman married to a man with 2 small children. I grew up without any queer representation around me. Obviously they were present, but not out at the time. And as I've grown up, my eyes have been opened to the wonderful and diverse world around me. I actually live with three gay men at university, and while I love those boys with all my heart, I'm embarrassed at my ignorance at their life and struggles. Podcasts like this and people like you, oh, are changing the world. Oh God, this is two that are like really lovely about me, and I feel immediately uncomfortable that I'm sharing them, like I'm bragging, because that's not a very British thing to do, is it? But I will carry on. Podcasts like this and people like you are changing the world to enlighten people like me so that we can help teach our children not only to embrace the difference in people around them, but also to be whoever they truly are. Being aware of the struggles outside of my upbringing can help me to help create the next generation filled with tolerance and understanding, allowing everyone to honour their true selves without restraint or denial. So much love and respect to you. And that's from Jodie, and she's also an avid listener of Like-Minded Friends. Jodie, that email really meant a lot to me. I didn't mean to share two today that were really braggy, but you know what? I'm going to take it. I'm absolutely delighted that that's how you feel. Well, I said at the beginning I had a bit of a spring in my step because it feels like there's been a hopeful turn in American politics today that maybe will filter across the rest of the world. And these two emails have continued that spring in my step. So thank you very much. There's been more emails in this week. I'm going to share more of them next week. As I promised you last week, I was going to try and get enough interviews to go all the way up to Christmas. I think I've done that. So I think I'll be with you all the way until Christmas, where you can hear me get more and more excited that Christmas is coming, because I absolutely bloody love Christmas. And although it might look a little bit different this year, that will not dim my spirit. I will be wearing a Santa hat and denying my partner with Christmas music from the 1st of December, as I do every year. Right, let's go on to today's episode. I thought this conversation was brilliant. I think Amru is brilliant. And I really hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Hello, listeners. Oh, listen, I am so excited for today's guest. So excited for the conversation we're going to have today. Amru Al-Kadi is a professional unicorn, a queer Iraqi non-binary Brit. In 2018, they were selected for the Screen International Star of Tomorrow and were one of six BFI BAFTA Flair LGBTQ plus filmmakers of 2017. As a writer-performer, they have numerous TV shows and films in development and has written on shows like Hollyoaks, Little America for Apple TV and The Watch for BBC America, amongst other things. Amru is also an established drag performer and actor. As well as a writer, they've written for The Guardian, Independent Voices, The Observer, Gay Times, The Eye Paper, and Attitude, amongst lots of others. Their debut book, Unicorn, A Journey from Shame to Pride and Everything in Between, has just been released in paperback. I'm reading it currently, and let me tell you, I am loving it. Don't just take my word for it, though. Russell T. Davies said, "It made me cry, it made me rage, it made me hoot. It moved my heart and soul." Ian McKellen said it should be read far and wide, and Joanna Lumley called it astonishingly brave and engaging, and I can't recommend it enough, guys. You've got to read it. What a treat it is to have them on the show today. Welcome, Amru.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, just looking at my dog in his cone, feeling really bad, but other than that, I'm okay.
How long have you had your dog? Did you get him at the beginning of lockdown?
No, I actually got him before sort of COVID was really like entering. It was like I got him on the 8th of February. But I mean, literally everyone's getting a puppy now. It's absolutely insane. I can't believe everyone I know has got puppies. But yeah, no, he has really been my savior throughout this lockdown.
What's his name?
His name is Phaedra.
Phaedra, I love it.
Yeah, he's just very melodramatic. And so I wanted to give him a sort of heightened diva name.
I love it. Much better than my mum's dog, which is called Ron. all of the puppies were named after characters in Harry Potter, and mum got Ron.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Very funny.
And he's Ginger. So it works. Although my mum does call him Ronald on a Ding Dong. So, you know, it's a different thing. But we're not here to talk about my mum's dog. That's not what we're doing today. We're going to talk about you. I was so keen to get you on the podcast because I've been reading lots of your stuff for quite a while now and following you on Twitter and in hearing about all the wonderful things that you do. And I just knew that you would be such an interesting guest for listeners that aren't aware of you. Obviously, also for those that are aware of you. So let's start back at the very beginning. That's an easy place to start. Where did you grow up?
I was actually born in London, but then moved to Bahrain in the Middle East when I was like two, and then lived between there and Dubai until I was around 11, and then came back to the UK, to London when I was 11, turning 12. So kind of, yeah, childhood in Bahrain and Dubai, and then sort of adolescence in the UK and onwards.
I mean, what did childhood in Bahrain look like?
My personal experience was that, I mean, it's pretty sort of relaxing at first. I mean, it was mostly just like living in a nice compound and swimming a lot and, you know, a lot of family time. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just quite cultural, but, you know, just a lot of, you know, Ramadan with the family and just yeah. sort of just very humble early life, you know, religious traditions, that kind of stuff.
And your family are quite sort of traditional and religious during your upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like how Muslims go, they're probably not that conservative. Like, right. you know, my mum doesn't sort of fully wear a kind of hijab and abaya, and my dad, you know, wears clothes that aren't like religious. So within the kind of like Muslim Middle East, you know, they're not uber conservative, but compared to kind of more sort of socially liberal values that are in the UK, they are quite conservative. But yeah, you know, they are sort of, you know, traditional Arabs who have a certain kind of belief system in sort of what's sort of appropriate and what kind of respect looks like, you know, very conservative socially, but not so yeah. much religiously.
Right. Okay. So having had that experience in Bahrain, and then I assume relatively similar in Dubai.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then what was it like sort of coming back to the UK? Was that a huge culture shock?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of was. I mean, I think like by the time that I was 11, which is when we were coming to the UK, I was already sort of aware, you know, internally that I was having a lot of questions in terms of sexuality and gender and that kind of stuff. But those things weren't, you know, permissible to think about or, right. or even question back in the Middle East. And actually, by that point, I had been in Islam class for quite a while, you know, really from about the age of 7. And a lot of fear had been sort of instilled in me in terms of like this real focus on hell and sin, actually, is sort of really a major part. I mean, kind of similar to Catholicism in a way, but, you know, constantly looking at sin and stuff. So by the time I came to the UK, I think I was quite excited to leave Muslim countries because I thought, ooh, well, maybe this won't be, you know, the West will be better for me as a kind of queer. So I was actually really excited to come to the UK and had a kind of, I think, quite a strong urge to sort of assimilate and sort of forget about a lot of the kind of fears I had around Islamic punishment and that kind of stuff. So it was a culture shock, but it was a sort of one that I kind of thrust myself into. And, that, you know, that had its merits and it's also its problems for sure. But yeah, I think, you know, as much as I kind of love the Middle East, I was already in my head beginning to doubt, oh God, you know, if I am gay or I am any of these things, then how is this going to kind of square up to my sort of faith and heritage and that kind of stuff. So I think, I thought, oh, maybe the UK will be a good place for me.
And so did you, when you came to London, did you start seeing queer people? Did you start seeing people that you thought, oh, that's sort of maybe similar to how I'm feeling?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. I mean, I saw none in Bahrain and Dubai, that's for sure. And, you know, it wasn't even kind of talked about. But yeah, just sort of like, you know, I have an uncle who has a British wife who live in the UK. And when, you know, we went over to their house, like she would have, you know, one of her gay friends round. And like when we would sort of go out to see something in the West End around Soho, definitely, you know, it was just like, oh, wow, look at all these people sort of just like existing kind of openly and proudly. I mean, but I was still obviously having to keep all those thoughts to myself. And there was definitely a kind of protection from my family about, you know, I was still only accessing those spaces with my family. And so it was like I was sort of, well, I was seeing it all around me, and I was like keeping aware, like, oh wow, you know, eventually maybe I'll be able to sort of integrate myself, you know, into that. But it was definitely a lot of fear, because I think I, you know, I could see them looking at me and sort of thinking, oh God, you know, we mustn't corrupt Amru because we're in this place where, you know, all these sort of vices are allowed. And so, you know, in many ways, maybe it like almost kind of made them sort of double down in terms of their policing of me.
And do you think that there was any inclination in the people around you that you were feeling like an outsider, or were you doing quite a good job at pretending?
No, I don't think I was doing a good job. I think like even sort of ants knew, to be honest. But like, you know, I think when you're that young, you know, you kind of femininity or whatever is just sort of seen as quite innocent. Or,
of course, yeah.
And, you know, I think definitely in my parents' head, you know, it was definitely very much like a thing that could just never be. You know, I think they really just in their head were just like,
it's impossible.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and I mean, I was warned when I was about 10, I told my family that I wanted to marry Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone.
Yeah, I've read this. I've read this.
Oh, and, you know, and there was like a real sort of panic, really, among my parents and their relatives of, you know, Amri, you really cannot say that, or you cannot even think that. So, you know, I was being sort of trained to conceive of like my sort of just innate desires as problematic or sinful. You know, there was, because I think they saw in me just a curiosity and like a kind of urge for exploration and kind of just like an implicit sort of otherness. And, you know, I think they were really worried. I mean, in a way, yeah, I think they were really like, oh God, we need to sort of nip this in the bud. And obviously you can't really nip that in the bud. And,
no.
And you know, nor should you. And so I think that was quite damaging for me, you know, especially at that young age, just sort of being trained to fear things that I suppose were just quite natural.
And also really encourages shame.
Totally encourages shame, which, you know, as so many queer people will sort of kind of attest to, it's really just built in you and can manifest with problems in your sex life or having intimacy or relationships.
I was reading a piece that you wrote. I mean, I don't know specifically where it's from because I've been reading lots of your work this week and enjoying it so much, I must say.
Oh, thank you.
You were talking about sort of feelings of worthlessness as a child and that sort of manifesting as OCD, which I've never realized. It really resonated with me because I so clearly remember, if I do this and I do that, then that will be okay. And OCD is something that sort of, I don't know if it is hereditary, but seems to run through my family.
Mm.
And you know, it's so comforting when you read something and go, oh yeah, that's what that was.
Mm.
It linked to that. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to talk about my experience, but I want to hear about yours. So yeah, you spoke about sort of the feelings of worthlessness sort of manifesting as OCD as a child.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of came in many forms. I mean, in its sort of purest form was from this practice in Islam where you kind of count all your sins on your left shoulder and then you put your good deeds on your right, and you're kind of sort of trained to like continually be keeping a tally. And so just from, you know, a young age, that sort of obsession with sort of counting how many times I was sinning to how many good deeds I was gaining was sort of quite manic in my head. And obviously I was sinning so much because sins were just sort of would come from, you know, I kind of say they're often like minor faults on a driving test, just kind of everything, right? Sort of like just thinking a negative thought or even sort of anything really. And then when you add in like kind of bigger sort of questions of sexuality and that kind of stuff, you feel like you're getting loads and loads. And good deeds are actually quite hard to do. So like, so from a young age, I have had that sort of like eye on the scale of like how many sins were on my left shoulder to good deeds. And then when I came to the UK and, you know, went to school, I was very much like, right, well, I may have all in my head, you know, may have all this sin, or, and, you know, my parents may end up rejecting me and I may be, you know, worthless or whatever. But if I can just get 100% in every single exam, then that will go away. And, you know, my God, like my teenage years were so self-punishing. I mean, I was like, 99% would have me kind of screaming and really torturous. And I've definitely recognized it just in sort of my drive. Like, I do work so hard, and actually I'm trying to now be slightly gentler with myself in terms of my work ethic and not to see it so much as a kind of race, because it's just very much like I am just like, gosh, I need to keep working, because as soon as I need to kind of keep up the good deeds in a way, and also prove to the world that I'm not worthless. So, but that's obviously, that's not an experience that's unique to me. I mean, I think so many queer people who, you know, are in the arts and have relative success in the arts often talk to me about this as well, of like, you know, having quite major drive to sort of compensate.
Yes. I mean, it's something that my friend Tom Allen, who's been on the show, I also do another podcast with, we've spoken about that at great deal, of constantly feeling like you've got to, you know, smash that project, then you've got to move on to the next one, do something equally as interesting, be, you know, just constantly sort of running to show everyone that what you're creating is good and it's worthwhile. I guess for me, certainly as when I was young, I mean, even I guess still now to a degree, I still sort of travel all over the country and I do have a good work ethic. But I think for a long time it was, well, if my parents can't be proud of this part of who I am, this gay part of who I am, then let me be really successful in this other area. So they've got something to tell their friends about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was like not even about like getting them to sort of tell their friends, but it's almost like, let me prove them wrong in a way.
Because
I was very much like billed as the sort of the problem child of the house and the problem child of the family. I mean, I was the scapegoat. I mean, there were constant sort of family interventions about my behavior, and especially with Iraqi communities. And bear in mind, this is around 2003. So we'd like, the UK had invaded Iraq. So there was a real sense of, like cultural territorialism, of like, you know, we are Iraqis living in the sort of country that bombed our homeland, so we need to protect our values and protect who we are. And I definitely noticed a kind of hardening of their conservative values.
Really? And was there a real sense of community amongst other Iraqis living in the UK?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we all knew each other, but as a result, but there are quite a strict kind of code of Islamic or cultural ethics in terms of, you know, you respect your elders, you know, boys do this, girls do this. And I was just like, I mean, I couldn't help it, but was just, you know, displaying complete nonconformism. And so I was the one who was sort of the scapegoat. So in a way, I had my academic work to, I mean, I took my GCSEs so seriously. It was almost like a joke. I mean, I literally like treated it like, I don't know, like I was diffusing, you know, a bomb that would literally ruin, like I had to get an A star in absolutely everything. Otherwise I would, you know, self-harm. I mean, it was that bad for me. And I did accomplish my goals, but then it was like, right, I need to do the same at A level. And then at university, it was like, right, I need to come top of my year. And actually, in terms of creativity, of, you know, then coming to London and doing drag and all that kind of stuff, I started to realize that like that kind of drive for perfection was actually hurting the work a little bit, because it was like I was scared to fail. And actually, drag has been a way for me to sort of fail a bit more in a fun way, like, you know, put on something and do a kind of, I mean, I love improv, for instance, right? Mm. I love interacting with an audience in drag and not having a rehearsed routine as such.
But you've got to be willing to fail, haven't you, to try that?
Totally. And I have failed a lot.
Oh, so have I. Don't worry about that. That's what you do, your learning, isn't it? As a performer, I think.
But I think it's also, it puts you in that place where you're living, when you're on stage, if you're on the cusp of failure, it's probably a really good performance, because you're like, you're really just living it and you're just doing it. And you know, if you're too worried about what everyone thinks and if everyone's laughing, you will kind of not do very well. And so that to me is why drag performing has been such a savior for me. I mean, I do a lot of screenwriting and I do notice my OCD sort of coming back there. But then again, if you're worried too much about like what people will think, you'll probably lose the spontaneity of characters sort of just playing around. But yeah, that's why creativity, I think, can be so great. Unfortunately, we do live industry where obviously you're always comparing yourself to other people, and you have to try and let go of that a little bit. But for me, definitely that work ethic. And when I just think how hard I was working as a teenager, I mean, I don't even think people at NASA work as hard as I did.
Because you must have got exceptional grades. I mean, from like reading your stuff and knowing about you and seeing if people haven't watched, there's a fantastic interview with you and Krishnan Gurumurthy. And I mean, you're obviously very, very bright and hugely intelligent. But you must have got exceptional grades because you then went to like an all boys boarding school. Is that right?
Well, yeah. So I did get very good grades. And then my first sort of port of call, because by the time I was 15, home was just so kind of traumatic and, you know, abusive. And so I was like, right, I'm going to use my grades to go to a boarding school. But I got a scholarship to Eton with a really kind of stupid idea in my head of like, well, the first idea I had was like, just get out of this house and live somewhere else so that you don't have to, you know, deal with all this sort of kind of constant violations towards my queer identity. But also because I was having such a sort of quite an almost binary idea of Islam and Arab culture as bad, just because of the attitudes I was experiencing within my context of, in terms of homophobia and transphobia and that kind of stuff, I was like, well, I guess I should, you know, go, you know, jump to the other side and become British. And, you know, so when I went to Eton, I definitely wanted to be like a kind of white aristocrat, which sounds really stupid. But like, I think I was just looking for the opposite to where I had been raised, thinking that that might be more of a kind of habitat for my queer identity and that kind of stuff.
I don't think that sounds really stupid, by the way. I think that totally makes sense to me that you go, okay, I'm going to do the total other of what I am. I think that's also something that I think is really common when we're sort of younger people.
Yeah, it's quite naive, I suppose, just because it's like, obviously, Eton had its huge problems with racism and homophobia and classism and, you know, was worse, actually. So, like, But I definitely, and I think this is something a lot of immigrants and queer immigrants definitely speak to me about, is this idea of if you're having a kind of fallout with your cultural heritage for various reasons, you know, you'll try and sort of latch on to the to another culture and assimilate within it. And so in terms of like immigrant exceptionalism of so many immigrants sort of trying to work so hard in order to kind of convince their new country that they are
a good immigrant.
Yeah, exactly. And definitely that is sort of, I think, a lot of the kind of kernel of what was going on when I wanted to go to Eton and wanted to sort of prove my Britishness. I mean, I'm definitely kind of over that now, but like, you're young and you can't really see, you know, I was about 15 and you can't really see the big picture. You know, you're just sort of just looking for a place to belong, and you'll probably choose somewhere quite hostile for a while.
Yeah, totally. But you're just searching.
Exactly. I mean, that's sort of life as a unicorn that my book is about, searching. Yeah. It's literally like about just constantly looking for somewhere new to belong. And I guess that's the sort of narrative of the book of is, you know, is there a place that can kind of hold all these sides of myself together?
You went on to Cambridge, is that right? So you continued doing the high achieving.
Yes.
And what did you study when you were there?
I did history of art and then kind of focused on sort of queer performance art.
Right. Okay. Because I want to get into that in a minute. But I want to talk about where marine biology comes into all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I loved reading about this. So I read that you were walking past a I was about to say fish shop, but that sounds like a fish and chip shop. You're walking about like a tropical fish shop, pet store type thing when you were around 13 and you had sort of an epiphany?
Yes. I mean, it was a kind of slow epiphany. I mean, I was having a really horrid time. I was around 13 and everything was so kind of complicated and just hard at home. And when I was walking home one day from school, I saw a kind of marine aquatics sort of shop where they sell kind of coral and marine fish and anemones and all just that kind of gorgeous stuff. And there was a huge tank in the window, and I was completely hypnotized by it, because, you know, like with marine biology, it's extraordinary, because it's like there's been a long tradition of queer people kind of being quite interested in sci-fi and the fact that it offers sort of another universe in a way. Yeah. And I think that was probably my first instance of like, oh, look at these alien life forms that don't seem to be restricted, you know, in the same way that we are on. Because what I was experiencing was such kind of firm categories of man, woman, you know, gay, straight, whatever, you know, all these binaries. And, you know, here I was just like watching kind of starfish just like having many legs that were all just kind of moving together, and then all these kind of colorful organisms sort of blending into one. And so I went into the shop and kind of asked about it, and then went home. And, you know, when I was, you know, reading about it at home, it was like, oh, wow, like, you know, there are even marine beings that change sex, and you know, just are just sort of inherently kind of fluid. And
yeah,
then I just became kind of transfixed and ended up kind of working at the shop every weekend, and then working there all over the summer, and then having my own marine tank at home. It was definitely like my first and probably my only kind of real childhood hobby of like this sort of kind of universe that I was sort of in charge of, and that was mine.
So was it when you were at Cambridge that you say you started looking at more queer performers?
Mm-hmm.
Had you considered performing yourself before? Was it something you'd ever sort of flirted with the idea of?
I'd actually been performing at school since I was around 12. Yeah, it was a lot of acting, and I'd you know, acted in a few kind of TV and film things like as a kid, but that was always just a little bit stifling, just because it was like really boring kind of Arab sort of representation on screen, which was all just kind of related to terrorism and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I'd always been quite sort of natural on stage, I think, because it was like, it was just sort of like a release in a way. It was just sort of, it was non-cerebral. Not in a, as in it was dumb at all, I think, but more that it was not something that was like you have to overthink in your head. You just get to go on stage and just sort of inhabit and be somebody else, or sort of, you know, be present. And as someone kind of with OCD and a lot of, and a very overactive brain, particularly academically, it was very like so nice to, you know, my OCD was often off when I was on stage. And so when I went to Cambridge, there was obviously such a good drama department there that I was just sort of kind of in theatre productions right from the off. But that is when I started a drag night, because I just, you know, all the theatre productions ended up obviously just being quite stale. And yeah. And that's where I sort of made Glamroo and really just explored that side of myself, and kind of the rest was history, I suppose.
And were you already out at this point?
I was out as gay to kind of people, and yeah, I mean, with my family, there was a sort of, they sort of found out I was gay through, unfortunately, finding porn. But you know, and there was a sort of, I mean, they were sort of so devastated, and then was just like, right, well, this is not going to happen again, and you know, we're going to fix this, and that we're just not going to talk about it again, and you're going to be straight. And you know, there was just a sort of inherent denial. So at home, it was very much like this thing that we just didn't talk about. But yeah, I was very, you know, when I went to Cambridge, it was really exciting, because it was my first, I suppose, like my first experience of being somewhere completely free, you know, like, you know, I suppose at Eton, you know, it was still a school where my parents were getting reports and there were teachers looking up,
yes,
you know, uni, you're just like free. So I really was just sort of wearing the maddest outfits on the street and wearing makeup and doing drag, you know. I guess that was where I just felt so free to liberate that side of myself. I'm so lucky to have gone there.
And did it feel like, do you remember that first moment when you went on stage in drag? Did you have that moment where you sort of went, oh, this is what I want to be doing, rather than doing these sort of stale old plays?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was obviously quite terrifying, because I like didn't really know what I was doing, but I've always seemed to people to be very like confident and outgoing on the exterior, and no one really like has any idea like the turmoil of like my internal emotional life. So when I started Denim, which was the drag troupe that I started, it was very much like I got my friends, was like, we should do this, and then I posted about it online, you know, and like 400 students came. And I think people just assumed like, oh, this person really knows what they're doing. But, you know, beforehand, I was trying to get into drag and I'd never done it before. And I was quite terrified and also feeling quite sort of alone, just because it was like, this is so like I'm doing this really sort of big extroverty sort of confident thing. And like, my God, you know, the truth of what's going on at home is so, so difficult. And everyone here probably just thinks that I'm, you know, out proud and in charge. But then genuinely once the sort of, you know, it wasn't really a stage because we did it in a crypt, but like, but once the sort of music started and I got the mic, it was just very like, it was probably the most naturally confident I felt on stage, because I wasn't worried about hiding being camp if I was playing, you know, a certain role or whatever. It was just like, boom. And I mean, it was a mess as well, like, because, you know, I'd always been able to sing, but I'd never sung live whilst being in drag. And, you know, there's, you know, mic technique takes years to do right. And, you know, it was like the sound was all over the place. But it was very freeing, and I was there with loads of good friends, and it was just very like, oh my God, it was a release, actually. It was just like, there we go. Yeah, I mean, as soon as that happened, it was like, right, got the bug, this is it, I'm doing this, yeah.
This is what I'm doing.
You know, and I'm lucky to have had that awakening. Like, I really wish everyone in their life could have a moment as sort of clear as that.
Yeah, I've had those moments where it almost feels like you're above yourself, watching yourself on stage, like sort of going, oh yeah, this is the thing.
Exactly that.
And so once you left Cambridge, did you come back to London and sort of get into the drag scene?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I'd probably say the first few years after Cambridge were probably like the worst of my life, just because you leave the bubble of university where, you know, everything was really high pressured. But it's not real. The stakes of it aren't real. I took it very real. But like, you know, you've got the bubble of a kind of institution, and suddenly it was like, right, there you go in London. And, you know, we started taking Denim. We started at the Bethnal Green Working Men's Club. I mean, but like, you know, I was making, I mean, you know, we're talking like 30 quid a performance.
Yes.
And you know, between 23 and 26, which is when I'd left Cambridge, you know, I, you know, hadn't got an agent yet. And this is pre everyone was like getting excited about like diversity in a way. And I always do say this to, you know, production companies and stuff who I meet now. I'm like, I have actually met you before years ago and you were horrible to me.
Really?
Yeah.
I've got to say, it doesn't surprise. I'm sorry that happened. But it also doesn't surprise me at all.
You know, or agents who ended up being like, oh, we really want to sign you. There's like buzz around you now. And it's like, I've only gone, the one I've gone for is the one who, you know, never laughed in my face when I was like, oh, this is really what I want to do, drag shows about the Middle East and, you know, that kind of stuff. Most people would be like, you know, no way. So those first 3 years, they were good in the sense that I'm really glad I did that hustle. Like, I mm-hmm. when I see people coming out and having bypassed that hustle, I'm like, there's just a bit of me that like inherently distrusts that they have what it takes, because like I've done performing basements every night for 20 quid and doing drag in the cab and it was really tiring, and I just remember being really broke and exhausted. But now that like I'm in a place where I'm lucky enough to like make money doing what I'm doing, and I appreciate it so much more. And actually it was a good chance to make mistakes and be bad at it before I, you know, got better at it.
Yeah, I often think that I made loads and loads of mistakes, but luckily not that many people were watching.
Yes, exactly that.
So I got to be quite bad at stand-up for a while with only 10 people in Edinburgh knowing every night.
But you have to be, in a way.
Yeah, I sort of hated it at the time because it felt like such a struggle, and you'd see people sort of whiz past you and you'd think, oh, I suppose I'm not as good as them, or I suppose. But now I'm really pleased I had that experience, because it made me work out that I really wanted it and made me really fight for my career, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So I would love to talk to you a bit more about your sort of bringing in your Muslim Arab heritage into drag.
Yeah, I mean, I guess not that consciously. I mean, I think like the sort of drag that I grew up in the UK, and the drag that I think has the most sort of potency is definitely coming from, like, you know, clubs and performance venues, and it's a lot more DIY, and it's a lot more kind of much more tied to sort of the trans community, and much more intersectional in terms of its thinking about race and gender, and just political and out there and messy. And you know my drag show, like I do love duets with sort of Allah, and for me a lot of my drag is about getting the audience to really question their own complicity and what's going on, and
yes,
and of the kind of live danger of like, what the hell is this queen going to do next, you know? And I like that kind of panic.
Yeah like I find, like, you know, drag is very political. But I think often that is missed in that sort of pageantry style of drag. Mm. You miss that sort of urgency of political stuff.
Where I kind of grew up doing drag, like through the Shay Shay Show, when I did performances there, I mean, we're like doing Basements in the Glory, wearing budget outfits, yeah, and like making people laugh and think and cry. And we don't really give a shit. I mean, every now and then, you know, I will treat myself to a really, really glam dress and just sort of feel the fantasy, and it's really, really wonderful. But like, definitely for me, drag is about looking at Islam and whether there's any queerness in Islam, looking at how colonialism made Islam homophobic, but also just like really thinking about the intersection of race and gender and making the audience uncomfortable. And I mean, the show was so kind of daring in that way.
I would love to chat to you about, because you were mentioning your sort of relationship with Allah and singing to Allah, and also your brilliant piece in the Book of Queer Prophets, mm-hmm, which, listeners, is a book that we discussed on Ruth Hunt's episode because she curated it. So it's definitely worth having a look at. Yeah, I was really interested to read lots of stories within that book, and yours especially, about a queer person's relationship to faith, and I guess also a non-binary person's relationship to faith. Is that, it feels like that's been a bit of a journey for you.
Yeah, it definitely has been a journey. I mean, sort of what I talk about in the book, and this was definitely something in my book and also the show that I was doing, Quran to Queen, was definitely about looking at, like, as a kind of person who's raised Muslim, Allah is someone sort of probably non-consensually that I was forced to sort of enter into a relationship with, enter into a dialogue with. And at points it was really harmonious and loving, and it was this sort of kind of unconditional support from this sort of entity. And then it became quite a sort of abusive relationship, in the fact that, you know, Allah had all these sort of expectations of me and stipulations and sort of rules. And so then, you know, it's a sort of presence that I've tried to divorce and tried to ghost and tried to kind of get rid of. But it being the kind of primary relationship in my life, kind of almost like my parents, it's a sort of entity that I've had to sort of have a dialogue with, just because it's like there and you can't.
Yeah.
For me anyway, it's not true of all people, but it's just for me anyway. So as I kind of talk about in the book, and, you know, the show was very much dramatizing that, you know, Allah was not verbalized because that's sort of not really allowed, or there was no picture of Allah, but it was just very sort of a presence that I was having a dialogue with, almost like Fleabag, but except it's Allah. And so definitely when I was sort of going back to Islam later in my life to sort of repair some wounds and repair some dynamics with family and that kind of stuff, it was useful for me to look at the Quran and connect with queer Muslim groups to see how there is all this other stuff in the Quran and also Islamic history that doesn't get taught, that is a lot more queer in essence, you know, really believing that Allah is a sort of non-binary force that changes to every different person and all this other stuff. So yeah, for me, it was like more of a way to remedy the existing relationship that I had, which had got really toxic.
Right. That's so interesting. And I think will be really hopeful for a lot of our listeners that have had sort of similar experiences. So I'll just move on to the final question of the podcast. But before, I would love to say to you, and I've enjoyed reading your stuff so much, and I just think that your story is so inspiring, and talking about mental health stuff and your journey to sort of becoming who you are and being out as who you are. We get so many emails in from young people, and actually, in fairness, older people, and from people that live in countries where homosexuality is still a criminal act or yet to be decriminalized. And I know that this episode is going to be a real source of hope. And that's exactly what I wanted to create when I started this podcast. So thank you.
No, thanks.
So the final question of the show is always the same. And sometimes I say, what advice would you give yourself? And or if you would prefer, what advice would you give someone who's in a similar situation, a different version of Amru, a young person that's in a similar place, maybe at Eton, maybe that little boy that was in the West End seeing people that were maybe a bit like him for the first time. If you could give them a piece of advice about what's to come, about who they are, what would you say?
I'd probably say, like, don't blame yourself. Like, and sort of, it's not your fault, because definitely little Amru was sort of trying to fix it as if it was a problem inherent inside them. So I would say, this is, you know, there's nothing to remedy.
Perfect. Thank you so much for listening today. I loved that. I hope you did too. So interesting. I highly recommend Amru's book, My Life as a Unicorn. Check it out, get it maybe at a local bookshop if they're selling stuff online now. I hope that you have a good week. I hope that your lockdown is going okay if you're listening to this in real time today. And take care of yourself, and I will be back with you next week. Or if you want to get in touch, Twitter, Susie Ruffle, Instagram, Susie Ruffle Comedy, and the email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. Take care of yourself, and I will see you. Well, I won't, but you will hear me, and I will reach out to you once again next week. Bye-bye.